12, and we're going to read together the opening 9 verses. The Lord had said to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you." So Abraham left as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot and all the possessions they had accumulated and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abraham traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moriah at Shechem. At that time the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went towards the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abraham set out and continued towards the Negev. And we thank God for his word. We'll remain seated and sing. As I indicated last week, we are starting a new series that will run. We'll see how long it goes on for. I suspect for a little while. Anyway, a little space in that. That must be one of my many typos. There we are. Abraham, the making of a man of faith. And we're looking at number one, forged in fire. And I wanted just to look at people who we know well as Bible characters. And often we're tempted to think these were great men and women of faith. They lived perfect lives. They didn't get anything wrong. And they did everything just the way they were supposed to all the time. Well, we know that's not true. And we're going to see how God, through the mistakes they made, the things that he allows them to go through, the things that happened to them, they have their impurities burnt off and burnt out from within them, as hopefully we will as well, as we go through life, and how the Lord forged them into the men and women of faith that ultimately they became known for. So they have their high points and their low points. It's very much a sort of warts and all story in the life of Abraham, and we're going to see that constantly through these next weeks and months together. But let's begin looking then at Abraham, and as I say, I've entitled it "The Making of a Man of Faith." He doesn't start out that way. That's how he ends. And actually, I think it'd be good for all the people we're going to look at. They are referred to as a man of faith in Abraham's case, or whatever it is that they are known for. But that's how they end up when God's finished dealing with them. It's not how they start off at the beginning of the story. And I think that's very encouraging, because quite frankly, we all need to hear that, don't we? Because none of us are the finished article. One day we will be, but that's not yet come. We're all a work in progress. And if God can do it for these individuals, he can do it for you and for me as well. So let's look then at this man, Abraham, the making of a man of faith. By virtue of the subject, we're not going to look at this in huge detail for any of these individuals. It's very much a kind of a bird's eye view. So we're going to cover huge amounts of material at a pretty surface level. And if you want to look at it in more depth at your own leisure, you are obviously free to do so. But let's begin looking at the formation, first of all, of Abraham, the man of faith, and then you see his failures and his family and the future that God has for him. I'm just going to work through these things quite quickly, because there's quite a lot of them. Here's his formation. He is obedient. There's obedience to God's call. That's at the start of the passage that we read this evening. God calls this man, and the implication is actually he'd called his father before him. You get hints of that in chapter 11. His father, Terah, that's his name, he doesn't actually complete the journey. He gets sidetracked. Terah was, we know, an idol maker. That was Abraham's dad's profession. He was an idol maker. And from what we know about Ur of the Chaldees, where he lived, it was a center of moon worship and the worship of various other pagan deities. So if you were an idol maker, that was a good place to stop and make money. It was only meant to be a pit stop, but the family end up living there permanently, and Terah dies, and he never actually ends up in the place where he'd been called to, because notice how it's phrased, how this was phrased, the Lord had said to Abraham, past tense. The family's been spoken to, and they've not fully responded to that call. Now here's Abraham, the next generation. The Lord had said to him, okay, it's your turn. What are you going to do? You've heard the call. You've heard the command of God. Are you going to come and follow me and walk with me or not? And he does it. Obedience to God's call. And Ur of the Chaldees was a very comfortable, pleasant place to live. It's almost certain that Abraham would have had a house. He would have had a roof and four good walls. And he walks out in that. And he spends the rest of his life living in a tent. Now, it wouldn't be a tent, the kind of tent that we have maybe when you go camping on holiday or whatever. These were really quite luxurious tents, but nevertheless, it was a tent. It was not a permanent dwelling. He ends up living as a permanent pilgrim, going as God leads him. He leaves the place of permanency and security, and he travels with God, not really knowing ultimately what God has for him, only until God begins to show it to him. Does he have the beginning of an idea? So there's obedience to God's call. That's chapter 12, verses 1 to 9. What happens next? It is followed in chapter 13, next chapter, by what I've called a wise and godly separation. Because he takes his nephew Lot with him. And if you'll pardon the pun, Lot wasn't a great Lot, really. He was a bit unwise. He was a man who compromised with things he shouldn't spiritually. He wanted a slice of the good life, and he wasn't too bothered if he placed himself in physical and spiritual danger in order to get it. And actually that is ultimately what happens. We are given the ominous warning that Lot, he pitches his tent, and we're told within sight of the great evil city of Sodom. Not a smart move, but that's what he does. And at this point, we're told that Abraham and Lot separate. Abraham goes one way, and Lot goes the other. Lot actually chooses the better portion of the land. Abraham says, the land is before you, take what you want, go where you wish. And Lot takes the better and the more prosperous part, but it was nearer the city of Sodom, not a good place to be living, because of how it was conducting itself. So Abraham, he's separated from the place of spiritual danger, but it's perhaps not quite as physically advantageous to him. But there's this wise and godly separation. But nonetheless, Abraham still loves his nephew. Because the next thing we see in the next chapter, chapter 14, he's got to go on a rescue. Because Lot, he's too near Sodom, and he gets caught up in their local politics, and he ends up being taken captive. He's minding his own business, and suddenly there he is in the middle of this war between the king of Sodom and those round about him. And Uncle Abraham has to strap on his bow and arrow and go off and rescue his son. So he rescues nephew, his Lot, in chapter 14. And coming back from the battle and successfully rescuing his rather wayward nephew in chapter 14, he is blessed by this interesting character that we looked at some months ago, Melchizedek, the king priest of Jerusalem. So Lot has to be rescued, and as we're going to notice very shortly, it's not for the first or the last time. And then there's a sort of a quieter period in Abraham's life, which is fair enough after all that he's done. Chapter 15, this is verses 1 to 6. He trusts God for the birth of a son. God says, I'm going to give you a son, even though you're old and your wife's old, and there's no chance physically that, normally speaking, you can have a son. Because Abraham's got all this money and wealth, and he says, well, I haven't got anyone to leave it to. I have no son of my body. Who am I going to give all this stuff to? And God says, don't worry, Abraham, I'm going to give you a son. And he promises him that he will have a son. And we're told that he trusts God for the birth of a son. And as Paul tells us, that it was credited to him as righteousness. So he trusts God for the future that God says that he has for him. And then we roll on a little bit further as well. What happens next? God then establishes his covenant with him. He believes, still chapter 15, verses 7 to 11 and 17 to 21. God says, right, Abraham, I'm going to make a covenant with you. You believe me? And from this one son you're going to have, it will be like the stars on the seashore. the stars in the heavens and the sand on the seashore. He will be the father and the head of a great nation. Because you believe me, from you all the nations are blessed. And we're actually here sitting in our building this evening as an expression of that great promise. God said to Abraham, I'm going to bless the world through you. And here we are. Those who have, like Abraham, we have put our faith and our trust in the living God. So God establishes a covenant with Abraham. He says, this is what I will do. And he makes that promise to him. But the covenant is renewed and it goes even deeper, because the next thing we see, this is into chapter 17 now, verses 1 to 27. God makes another covenant, or he affirms a covenant, and he makes it with this covenant of circumcision that he makes with Abraham. And that was a sign and a seal in their flesh that the promise that God had given to Abraham, he was going to fulfill it. And it was the idea of separation to God. Every male, both members of the family, if they were slaves, all of them had to be circumcised. And that was the sign that they were part of this covenant that God had made with Abraham, and that they, as part of that covenant, were going to be under his hand of blessing and protection. It also meant, of course, they had to be obedient. They had to worship the true living God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as he was to become known. They were not to worship the false gods. They were to be faithful in their worship to the living God. And so this covenant of circumcision is made. But then time goes by, and the rhythm of life, Bedouin life as it would have been, carries on. But yet there is still no son. And we get to chapter 18 and the opening 15 verses. There's the renewal of God's promise. Abraham and Sarah are waiting for this long-promised baby, this long-promised son, and nothing's happening. And God, he appears to Abraham and he speaks to him and he says, I'm going to remind you of the promise that I made. And of course we're told that his wife Sarah, she laughs. She says, well, how can I have a baby? She says, I'm well past it. I'm far too old for childbearing. She doesn't really believe. And of course God says to her, well, you laughed. And she denied that she laughed. She lied, but she did. But God nevertheless says, this time next year I will return. And you will be nursing a baby. And that, of course, is what happened. So we see the beginning of the unfolding of the promise. It's renewed, and then ultimately it comes to pass. And then the scene changes again. And it becomes a little bit more dark and a bit more menacing. Because God, the best way I can describe this is that he really takes Abraham into his confidence, actually, with the revelation of God's punishment. And we see Abraham's intercession for his family. This is Genesis 18, verses 16 to 33. God, we're told, looks at what was going on in Sodom, and he has decided that he is going to destroy it. He's going to punish it and wipe it off the face of the earth. Such is its wickedness. It's quite interesting. It says that he has come down to see what is going on, for a cry has come up against them to him. So God knows what's going on, and he is sickened by what he sees, and he decides that he is going to act. But he tells only one person that which is in his holy and eternal heart, and that is Abraham. Abraham is a friend of God. He takes Abraham into his confidence. He shares with Abraham, this is what is in my mind and this is in my heart. But of course, at this point, things are not so good as far as Abraham is concerned. Why? Because Lot, unfortunately, by this time, has moved into the city. It's actually quite interesting to look at Lot. He pitches his tent outside. He begins to trade with the people of the town. The next thing we are then told into chapter 19, that he's moved in to the city, and by this time he's also become a judge, which was quite a compliment. He was a man of honesty and integrity, but he's living in a city that is full of sin and quite obvious immorality, and he is struggling to remain faithful to what he knows is true in the midst of a deeply morally and sexually and socially compromised city and situation that he's in. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time, because God's hand of judgment is upon the city and it's about to get wiped clean off the face of the earth. And Uncle Abraham is being told by God, they're on borrowed time. I'm going to deal with them and my punishment is going to fall upon them. And so what does Abraham do? He intercedes. Will you have mercy? And he counts it down. 100 people, 50 people, 10 people. Will you spare the city for the sake of 10 righteous persons? And of course he's thinking about his nephew, Lot. And of course we know what God does. He sends an angel and Lot is rescued. And his family are rescued. Basically, as brands from the burning, and they're running out the main gate of the town, a city, and God is coming in judgment upon them, and they are pulled back from judgment and disaster because of the intercession of Abraham. Good little point for us to think about, friends, that when we intercede for those who do not yet know the Lord, when we intercede for those who once walked with him and are backslidden and are not walking with him, make sure that you continue to intercede for them, because you may be the person that God is using to pull that person back from the brink of disaster. Lot, he escapes Sodom and the smell of burning is on his clothes. And the reason that happens is because his uncle interceded before God on his behalf. Quite a remarkable story. We can look at that in more detail another time. And then we move on again. Genesis chapter 22. Getting towards the latter part of Abraham's life. His willingness to offer his son, Isaac, as a sacrifice to God. Genesis 22 verses 1 to 19. It's quite interesting actually the way it's phrased. It talks about Isaac, describes Isaac as a boy. Actually, he wasn't a boy. He was probably a young man in his early 20s. And Abraham is certainly getting towards his 100th year. And if Isaac didn't really want to go through with this, he could have just pushed his dad out of the way and saved himself. But these two guys go up this mountain, and Isaac's put out, ready to be sacrificed. The knife is pulled out, and God says, stop, don't do it. Now I know I have your whole heart, because you're willing to offer your son as a sacrifice to God. And actually Isaac was part of that. He played his part in that. And we have that incredible story. It's actually very, very well rounded in the King James. We have fire and we have wood, but we do not have a sacrifice. And Abraham has captured, as I say, well, in the AV, this wonderful prophetic word that resonates down through the years of time. God will provide a ram. God will provide a lamb. God will provide a lamb. Abraham says that. And when God says, no, stay your hand, don't kill him. And they look up, and what do they find? A ram, a male sheep, without spot or blemish, caught in the thicket, and they sacrifice that. And that pointing forward to the Lord. But Abraham is willing to offer his son as a sacrifice to God. So there we have the formation of this man. From leaving home to this high point, really, on Mount Moriah. And God says, I know that I have your heart. I know that I have your love. But just for a few that you think it's all wonderful, Abraham does mess up as well. He makes mistakes. He has quite serious and significant failures as well that I want to look at. I've got four jotted down here. First of all, he did not wait for God's guidance and acted on his own initiative. Genesis 12 begins well. Verses 1 to 9, great, God's called him. He says, right, Lord, I'll go. Wonderful. What happens next? Well, we get into Genesis 12 and you start from verse 10 down to the end of the chapter. But notice how it begins. It does not begin with the phrase, and God said to Abraham, go. It just says that Abraham went. He took himself off to Egypt. He went to a place that God actually had not given him specific guidance to go to. He just thinks, right, I'm going to go to Egypt. That's the right place for me to go. He doesn't ask God. He doesn't wait for God's guidance. He acts on his own initiative. And that can be a big mistake. And I'm sure all of us at some point have done that. We're not prepared to wait for God's guidance. We're just going to go off and do our own thing. And even as Abraham is learning to step out in faith, and he's made this big, incredible decision, immediately after he blows it and he makes a mess. And you know, friends, that's exactly how we are as well. God can call us to do something and we do it and we know God's blessing, and the next thing we're flat on our faces because we've done something else and we shouldn't have. We've not waited on God. We've not asked for his guidance. We've not acted in the way that he's commanded us to do. We just thought, this is the right thing. I'm going to go off and do my own thing. And that's what Abraham does. And actually, it's a big mistake, because what happens next? Look at verses 11 to 20 in Genesis 12. He engaged in deceit, which led to God's punishment and others, because he passes his wife off as his sister. And Pharaoh thinks, this is quite good. This is wife number, whatever. And he decides he's going to have this this man's sister as part of his harem. And she is taken into his harem. Fortunately, he does not sleep with her. But of course, he has the punishment of God inflicted upon him and upon his entire family. And he says to Abraham quite reasonably, look, he says, you've deceived me. This is not my fault. I didn't know this. And here is Abraham, God's man, the man of faith, the man that God is going to use and be a means of blessing. And he's been caught in one of his own lies. And he is being rebuked by a pagan king of Egypt. The Pharaoh is saying, you're not behaving in the way you should be. And that's quite a rebuke for somebody who is seeking to walk with God as a believer. And is actually being rebuked by someone who we would say is unsaved, by someone who does not know the living God. And that happens again. The other example you would know and remember is in Jonah. Jonah, he's a prophet of God. And God says, I want you to go to Nineveh. And he says, forget it. I don't want to go there. I'm going to go somewhere else. And he ends up in the boat and there's a great storm. And he has to come clean and say, yes, I'm a prophet of God. I shouldn't be here. The reason that this storm is going on is it's my fault. And what happens? He is rebuked by the captain of the boat, who isn't a follower of the God of Israel. He says, why are you sleeping? Call upon your God. Maybe he might save us. He is rebuked for his faithlessness, and he is rebuked also for his prayerlessness as well. So here's Pharaoh saying to Abraham, the great man of God, why have you done this? You've deceived me. You've lied to me. You've not told the truth. Decisions have consequences. One thing leads to another, and it's not quite so good. But then we go on into chapter 16. We get into some even more serious territory. He is impatient for the fulfillment of God's promise and acts foolishly. Years go by. The promised son hasn't arrived. So his wife says, well, there's my maidservant. Go and sleep with her, and maybe you can raise up a son through her. And, of course, that happens. And we know how that ends up. We have Ishmael and Hagar, and we have this great division running right the way through the family. And the division actually is still there. We see that being worked out even in modern day times in the Middle East. And here are the reasons. Human beings think, let's push the hand of God. Let's interfere. Let's give God a nudge along the road we think he should be acting. Don't do it. Don't be impatient. Wait and do not act foolishly or precipitously. And that is what Abraham does. And my goodness, he pays a heavy price. Chapter 16 of Genesis 1 to 4. And it resonates down to the rest of his life and on beyond it as well. And the result, not surprisingly, this is chapter 16 and verse 21, and also chapter 21 and the first 21 verses, there is family discord and division. And it goes on for a long, long time. And Paul picks up on that. You can read about it when you go home in Galatians. There's the son of the slave woman and the son of the freeborn. And there's this great division in the family spiritually, between the line that God's going to bless and the one that he is not going to use in that way. And there's family tension within the family of Abraham, between himself and his wife and her maidservant, because of the decision that they made. So Abraham, he has his high moments, but he messes up, and he has his moments of failure as well. But how does the big picture finally come together, and how does it end? Well, let's look at his family and future. And I've got a few things jotted down here. First of all, there's the birth of his son. Eventually, it happens. Chapter 21 and the opening five verses. The birth of a long-promised son arrives, and he's given the name Isaac. And as you may know, Isaac means literally, I laugh. A bit of irony here. Sarah's laughing to herself, a sort of sarcastic, mocking laugh. Me have a son at my age? No chance. And she laughs. And she gives birth to a son, and she names him Isaac. She laughed, but God got the last laugh. And that's what happens there, the birth of his son. Then there's the beginning of a great nation, again, the same verses. Through Isaac, as we know, there was going to be Jacob and all his 12 sons, and ultimately the birth of the nation of Israel, the beginning of a great nation. From one man, as scripture says, who was as good as dead, the promise of God was fulfilled through that one individual. Then there's the building of a family line. The family line of Abraham begins to start to be developed, and it's done in two ways. First of all, it is done by means of separation. You'll see that in Genesis 21, verses 8 to 20. Ishmael and Isaac, those two branches of the family, they separate off permanently, and they both go their own ways in the will and in the purposes of God. So the separation, the true line, the line that God is going to work his blessing down through, leading ultimately to Jesus, that is established and built up by means of separation. But also, secondly, verse chapter 24, in terms of the search for a wife for Isaac. It's quite interesting. We don't know an awful lot about Isaac. There's a lot about Abraham, and there's a lot about Jacob, as we've looked at his life in much more detail in recent months. Isaac is a kind of quieter individual. We don't know much about him, but from what we do know, he seemed to be a very quiet, unassuming man. He liked to go off and meditate in the fields. So he was a quiet, thoughtful man, but we don't really know an awful lot about him. But nevertheless, God made his covenant with him, as he had with his father. And at that point, Abraham decided, it's time to get a wife for my son. That the family line, the line of blessing, the line of promise, will continue. And you can read about that and how he sends his servant, and Rebecca is found to be the wife of Isaac, building the family line. And of course, they became the parents of Jacob and Esau. And then we see not just a birth, we see also a death, because the story begins to wind up ultimately to its conclusion. There is the burial of his wife in chapter 23 that he loved, and he buys a plot of ground in the land of Canaan. He's promised this land by God, but he doesn't actually possess it. He never possesses it apart from this little bit of ground. And that's a sort of bit of seed ground, as it were. He owns this ground. He's promised the whole land, but he owns a bit. So he's got his foot in the door. And the promise that God gives, the land will be not all Abraham's, but it will be for all of Abraham's descendants, as you know. And he's given this little bit of ground. He buys it, and he buries his wife there. And he's buried there, of course, as you know, as well, later on. The burial of his wife. But also God comes to Abraham, and he gives him a bit of a window on tomorrow. He reveals to him what's going to happen. There's a prediction of future suffering and deliverance. And he does this in the context, actually, of the covenant he makes. This is back into Genesis 15, verses 12 to 21. It's quite interesting what happens. God comes to Abraham, and he begins to speak to him, and we're told that the sky was dark. That nature reflected physically the nature of the message and the prophetic prediction that God was giving to him. The two, it would appear, were in perfect agreement. And it says, Abraham, you're going to be the head of a great nation, but they are going to know great suffering. They're going to be enslaved. They're going to go through all kinds of terrible things. But it will not be forever, and there is coming a great deliverance. Here is God predicting to Abraham the Exodus. And we haven't even got to the three patriarchs yet. We haven't even got to Joseph being sold off as a slave to get Jacob's family ready into the land of Egypt. And we haven't had the 400 years of the people of God enslaved and crying out to God. Moses hasn't even yet been born. King Ramses II hasn't yet become even Pharaoh of Egypt. And God says, that's coming. Great blessing, great suffering, but also a great deliverance. And he shares again. He takes Abraham into his confidence, and he gives him that taste, that sense of what is going to happen in the future. That is the future. You won't live to see it, but you will see it. You're going to hear about it. And that's why the writer to the Hebrews says that those who traveled by faith, they heard of these things and they welcomed them, but they didn't see them. Here's a good example. Abraham doesn't see these things, but he heard about them, he welcomed them, and he believed them. How? Because he was learning to be a man who walked by faith. And how does the story end? Well, it ends in chapter 25, and the opening 11 verses, the death of the man of faith. He lives a long time, he dies a very old man, and he has learned all of these great lessons of grace. God has fashioned and forged this man over many, many years, and he's done it by means of some significant and serious failures that Abraham, like all of us, makes. But in the midst of all of this, never mind all that he goes through, God is using it to work his purposes out for Abraham's future and for that of his family. And because of that, we are here sitting in church this evening, because God was faithful to Abraham as Abraham learned to walk faithfully day by day with him. Didn't happen overnight. It was a lifetime's journey. But as Paul says, he who began a good work in you, he will bring it unto completion on the day of Christ Jesus. He does it for Abraham. He does it with all the other people we're going to look at, these great Old Testament saints. And if he can do it for them, we who live on the other side of Calvary, we who live on the other side of the Lord's resurrection, how much more, therefore, can he do it for you and for me? Let's take encouragement, friends, and take heart from what we've been looking at tonight. God's begun a good work in you. And it's being worked out differently for you as it is for me. But God is working on you. And he will not leave you as you are. He will keep working on you until you become like Jesus. And you stand before Jesus. And you see him face to face, eye to eye. And he says, there's my son, there's my daughter. I have made them perfect. I began the good work. I have forged them to the fires of adversity and living in a fallen world, and by my grace and means of my providence, and there they are now perfect. Perfect before me, to worship before the throne of God and to give to the Lord their worship and their praise. Let's pray together. Lord, we thank you that, Lord, you do take ordinary people, and Lord, you forge them, you purify them. You make them, Lord, far more than they ever thought they could be. And you make them into the men and women, Lord, that you want them to be, Lord, for their blessing and for your glory. Lord, as that was Abraham's experience and the experience of all the others we're going to look at over these next weeks and months together, we pray, Lord, that for us, in our lives, in our circumstances, in our day and generation, in the time in which we live, may that be our experience too, that we can prove the faithfulness of our God. For this we ask. In your name. Amen.